8. The police photos of Mitch's house make it look cramped and spooky, as if destined for its fate. The fat, splintered beams along the ceiling, the stone fireplace, its many levels and hallways, like something in the Escher lithographs Mitch collected from a gallery in Sausalito. The first time I encountered the house, I remember thinking it was as spare and empty as a coastal church. There was very little furniture, the big windows in the shape of chevrons, herringbone floors, wide and shallow steps. From the front door, you could already see the black plain of bay spreading past the house, the dark, rocky bank, the houseboats knocking peaceably against each other, like cubes of ice. Mitch poured us drinks while Suzanne opened his refrigerator, humming a little song as she peered at the shelves, making noises of approval or disapproval, lifting tin foil off a bowl to sniff at something. I was in awe of her at moments like that, how boldly she acted in the world, in someone else's house, and I watched our reflections wavering in the black windows, our hair loose on our shoulders. Here I was, in this famous man's kitchen, the man whose music I'd heard on the radio. The bay out the door, shining like patent leather. And how glad I was to be there with Suzanne, who seemed to call these things into being. Mitch had a meeting with Russell earlier that afternoon. I remember noticing it was strange that Mitch had been late for it. 2 o'clock had passed, and we were still waiting for Mitch. I was silent, like they all were, the quiet between us expanding. A horsefly bit at my ankle. I didn't want to shoo it away, conscious of Russell a few feet away, perched on his chair with his eyes closed. I could hear him humming under his breath. Russell had decided it would be best for Mitch to come upon him sitting there, his girls surrounding him, Guy at his side, the troubadour with his audience. He was ready to perform, guitar laid across his knees, his bare foot jiggling. There was something in the way Russell was fingering the guitar, pressing silently on the strings. He was nervous in a way I didn't know how to decipher yet. Russell didn't look up when Helen started whispering to Donna, just a low whisper. Something about Mitch, probably, or some stupid thing Guy had said. But when Helen kept talking, Russell got to his feet. He took a moment to lay the guitar against his chair, pausing to make certain it was stable, then walked over swiftly and slapped Helen in the face. She gave an involuntary yip, a strange burble of sound, her wide-eyed hurt draining quickly into apology, blinking fast so the tears wouldn't fall. It was the first time I had ever seen Russell react that way, the cut of anger aimed at one of us. He couldn't have hit her. The stupid blare of sun made that impossible, the hour of afternoon. The idea was too ludicrous. I looked around for confirmation of the frightening breach, but everyone was staring pointedly away, or had arranged their faces into disapproving masks, like Helen had brought this on herself. Guy scratched behind an ear, sighing. Even Suzanne seemed bored by what had happened, like it was no different from a handshake. The vinegar in my throat, my sudden, despairing shock, seemed like a failing. And soon enough, Russell was petting Helen's hair, tightening her lopsided pigtails, whispering something in her ear that made her smile and nod, like a goopy-eyed baby doll. When Mitch finally showed up at the ranch an hour late, he was bearing much-needed supplies, a cardboard flat of canned beans, some dried figs, and chocolate spread, rock-hard Packham pears, individually wrapped in pink tissue paper. He let the kids clamber up his legs, though normally he shook them off. Hi, Russell, Mitch said, a lace of sweat on his face. Long time no see, brother, Russell said. He kept his grin steady, though he didn't get up from his chair. How goes the great American dream? Things are good, man, he said. Sorry I'm late. Haven't heard from you in a while, Russell said. Breaking my heart, Mitch. Been busy, Mitch said. A lot going on. There's always a lot going on, Russell said, looking around at us, making long eye contact with Guy. Don't you think? Seems like there's a lot going on, and that's what life is. Think it only stops when you die. Mitch laughed, like everything was fine, passing out the cigarettes he'd brought, the food, like a sweating Santa. The books would identify this as the day things turned between Russell and Mitch, though I didn't know any of this at the time. Didn't pick up on any meaning in the tension between them. Russell's fury muffled by a calm, indulgent exterior. Mitch had come to give Russell the bad news that there would be no record deal for Russell after all. The cigarettes, the food, all of it meant as a consolation. Russell had been hounding Mitch for weeks about the supposed record deal, pushing and pushing, wearing Mitch down, sending Guy to deliver cryptic messages to Mitch that could oscillate between threatening and benign. Russell was trying to get what he believed he deserved. We smoked some grass. Donna made peanut butter sandwiches. I sat in the circle of shade cast by an oak. Nico was running around with one of the other kids, chins crusted with remnants of breakfast. He snapped a stick at a bag of trash, the garbage spilling everywhere. Nobody noticed but me. Guy's dog was out in the meadow, the llamas high-stepping in agitation. I was stealing looks at Helen, who seemed, if anything, insistently happy, like the exchange with Russell fulfilled a comforting pattern. The slap should have been more alarming. I wanted Russell to be kind, so he was. I wanted to be near Suzanne, so I believed the things that allowed me to stay there. I told myself there were things I didn't understand. I recycled the words I'd heard Russell speak before, fashioned them into an explanation. Sometimes he had to punish us in order to show his love. He hadn't wanted to do it, but he had to keep us moving forward for the good of the group. It had hurt him, too. Nico and the other kid had abandoned the trash pile, squatting in the grass with their heavy diapers sagging. They spoke rapidly to each other in serious, Asiatic voices, with sober, rational inflection, like the conversation of two little sages, breaking into sudden, hysterical laughter. It was late in the day. We drank the dirty wine they sold by the gallon in town, sediment staining our tongues, a nauseous heat. Mitch had gotten to his feet, ready to head home. "Why don't you go with Mitch?" Russell suggested, squeezing my hand in submerged code. Had a look passed between him and Mitch? Or maybe I'm imagining that I witnessed that exchange. The logistics of the day were shrouded in confusion, so that somehow it was dusk, and Suzanne and I were driving Mitch back to his house, hurtling along the back roads of Marin in his car. Mitch was sitting in the back seat, Suzanne driving. I was up front. I kept catching sight of Mitch in the mirror, lost in an aimless fog. Then he'd jolt back into himself, staring at us with wonderment. I didn't fully understand why we'd been chosen to take Mitch home. Information passed through selectively, so all I knew was that I got to be with Suzanne. All the windows open to the smell of summer earth and the secret flash of other driveways, other lives, along that narrow road in the shadow of Mount Tam. The loops of garden hoses, the pretty magnolia. Suzanne drove in the wrong lane sometimes, and we shrieked with happy and confused terror, though there was a flatness to my yelling. I did not believe anything bad could ever happen. Not really. Mitch changed into a white pajama-like suit, a souvenir from a 3-week sojourn in Varanasi. He handed us each a glass. I caught the medical whiff of gin, and something else too, a tinge of bitterness. I drank it, easily. I was almost pathologically stoned, and I kept swallowing, my nose getting stuffy. I laughed a little to myself. It seemed so odd to be in Mitch Lewis's house, among his cluttered shrines and new-looking furniture. "The airplane lived here for a few months," he said. He blinked heavily. "With one of those dogs," he continued, staring around at his house. "The big white ones. What are they called? Newfoundlands? It tore up the lawn." He didn't seem to care that we were ignoring him. He was out of it, glazing over with silence. Abruptly, he got to his feet, putting a record on, turning the volume up so loud I startled, but Suzanne laughed, urging him to make it louder. It was his own music which embarrassed me. His heavy belly pressed against his long shirt, as flowing as a dress. "You're fun girls," he said, dimly, watching Suzanne start to dance, her dirty feet on the white carpet. She'd found chicken in the refrigerator and had torn off a piece with her fingers, chewing while she moved her hips. "Kona chicken," Mitch remarked. "From Trader Vic's." The banality of this remark, Suzanne and I caught each other's eyes. "What?" Mitch said. When we kept laughing, he did too. "This is fun," he repeated over the music. He kept saying how much some actor he knew liked the song. "He really got it," he said. "Wouldn't stop playing it. Tuned in guy." It was new to me that you could treat someone famous like they weren't that special, that you could see all the ways they were disappointing and regular, or notice the way his kitchen smelled of trash that hadn't been taken out. The phantom squares on the wall where photographs had once hung, the gold records leaned against the baseboard, still wrapped in plastic. Suzanne acted like it was really only she and I that mattered, and this was all a little game we were playing with Mitch. He was the background to the larger story, which was our story, and we pitied him and felt grateful to him, at the same time, for how he sacrificed himself for our enjoyment. Mitch had a little Coke, and it was almost painful to watch him shake it out carefully onto a book about TM, staring at his own hands with a queer distance, like they didn't belong to him. He cut 3 lines, then peered at them. He fussed around until one was markedly bigger and snorted it quickly, breathing hard. "Ah," he said, leaning back, his throat raw and pricked with golden stubble. He held out the book to Suzanne, who danced over, sniffing up a line, and I did the last one. The Coke made me want to dance, so I did. Suzanne grabbing my hands, smiling at me. It was a strange moment. We were dancing for Mitch, but I was eaten up by her eyes, how she urged me on. She watched me move with pleasure. Mitch was trying to talk, telling us some story about his girlfriend, how lonesome he'd been since she'd left for Marrakesh, on some tear about needing more space. "Baloney," he kept saying. "Ah, baloney." We were indulging him. I took my lead from Suzanne, who nodded when he spoke, but rolled her eyes at me, or loudly urged him to tell us more. He was talking about Linda that night, though her name meant nothing to me. I was barely listening. I'd picked up a small wooden box, rattling with tiny silver balls, and tipped it, trying to get the balls to drop into holes painted to look like the mouths of dragons. Linda would be his ex-girlfriend by the time of the murders. Only 26, though that age seemed vague to me then, like a knock on a faraway door. Her son Christopher was 5 years old, but had already been to 10 countries, bundled along on his mother's travels, like the pouch of her scarab jewelry. The ostrich skin cowboy boots she stuffed with rolled up magazines so they'd keep their shape. Linda was beautiful, though I'm sure her face would have grown bawdy or cheap. She slept in bed with her golden-haired little boy, like a teddy bear. I was so lulled into feeling that the world had winnowed itself around Suzanne and me, that Mitch was just the comic fill. I didn't even consider other possibilities. I'd gone to the bathroom, used Mitch's strange black soap, and peeked in his cabinet, loaded with bottles of dilaudid. The enamel shine of the bathtub, the cut of bleach in the air, so I could tell he had a cleaning lady. I had just finished peeing when someone opened the bathroom door without knocking. I was startled, reflexively trying to cover myself. I saw the man sliver a glance toward my exposed legs before he ducked back into the hallway. "Apologies," I heard him say from the other side of the door. A chain of stuffed marigold birds swung gently from where they hung by the sink. "My deepest apologies," the man said. "I was looking for Mitch. Sorry to bother you." I sensed him hesitate on the other side of the door, then tap the wood lightly before he walked away. I pulled up my shorts. The adrenaline that spread through me lessened but didn't disappear. It was probably just a friend of Mitch's. I was jumpy from the coke, but I wasn't frightened, which made sense. Nobody thought until later that strangers might be anything but friends. Our love for one another boundless. The whole universe an extended crash pad. I'd realize a few months after that this must have been Scotty Weschler, the caretaker who lived in the back house, a tiny white-paneled cabin with a hot plate and a space heater. The man who cleaned the hot tub filters and watered the lawn and checked that Mitch hadn't overdosed in the night. Prematurely balding, with wire glasses, Scotty had been a cadet at a military academy in Pennsylvania before dropping out, moving west. He never shook his cadet idealism. He wrote letters to his mother about the redwoods, the Pacific Ocean, using words like majestic and grandeur. He'd be the first, the one who tried to fight back, to run. I wish I could squeeze more out of our brief encounter. To believe, when he opened the door, that I had felt a shiver of what was coming. But I'd made out nothing but the flash of a stranger, and I thought of it very little. I didn't even ask Suzanne who the man was. The living room was empty when I came back, the music blaring, a cigarette leaching smoke in the ashtray. The glass door that led out to the bay was open. I was surprised by the suddenness of the water when I went out on the porch. The wall of woolly lights. San Francisco in the fog. No one was out on the bank. Then I heard, over the water, a distorted echo. And there they were, both of them, splashing in the waves, the water foaming around their legs. Mitch flapping around in his white outfit, now like soggy bedsheets. Suzanne in the dress she called her Br'er Rabbit dress. My heart lurched. I wanted to join them. But something held me in place. I kept standing on the stairs that led to the sand, smelling the sea-softened wood. Did I know what was coming? I watched Suzanne shed her dress, shrugging it off with drunken difficulty. And then he was on her, his head lowering to lick at her bare breast, both of them unsteady in the water. I watched for longer than seemed right. I was buzzy and adrift by the time I turned my back and wandered into the house. I turned the music down, shut the refrigerator door, which Suzanne had left open, the picked-over carcass of the chicken. Kona chicken, as Mitch had insisted. The sight made me a little nauseous, the two pink flesh emanating a chill. I would always be like this, I thought, the person who closed the refrigerator, the person who watched from the steps like a spook while Suzanne let Mitch do whatever he wanted. Jealousy started to oscillate in my gut, the strange gnaw when I imagined his fingers inside her, how she'd taste of salt water. Confusion, too. How quickly things had changed, and I was the one on the outside again. The chemical pleasure in my head had already faded, so all I recognized anymore was the lack of it. I wasn't tired, but I didn't want to sit on the couch, waiting for them to come inside. I found an unlocked bedroom that looked like a guest room. No clothes in the closet. A bed with slightly mussed sheets. They smelled like someone else, and there was a single gold earring on the nightstand. I thought of my own home, the weight and feel of my own blankets. Then a sudden desire to sleep at Connie's house. Curled up against her back in our familiar, ritual arrangement, her sheets printed with chubby cartoon rainbows. I lay in the bed, listening for the sound of Suzanne and Mitch in the other room. Like I was Suzanne's thick-necked boyfriend, the same ratchet of righteous anger. It wasn't aimed at her, not exactly. I hated Mitch with a fierceness that kept me wide awake. I wanted him to know how she'd been laughing at him earlier, to know the exact degree of pity I had for him. How impotent my anger was. A surge with no place to land, and how familiar that was. My feelings strangled inside me, like little half-formed children, bitter and bristling. I was almost certain, later, that this was the same bedroom that Linda and her little boy were sleeping in. Though I know there were other bedrooms, other possibilities. Linda and Mitch were broken up by the night of the murder, but they were still friends, Mitch delivering an oversized stuffed giraffe on Christopher's birthday the week before. Linda was only staying at Mitch's because her apartment in the Sunset was crawling with mold. She'd planned on being at his house for 2 nights. Then she and Christopher would stay in Woodside with her boyfriend, a man who owned a series of seafood restaurants. After the murders, I had seen the man on a talk show, face red, pressing a handkerchief to his eyes. I wondered if his fingernails were manicured. He told the host he'd been planning to propose to Linda, though who knows if that was true. Around 3 in the morning, there was a knock on my door. It was Suzanne, stumbling inside without waiting for an answer. She was naked, bringing a gusty smell of brine and cigarette smoke. "Hi," she said, pulling at my blankets. I'd been half asleep, lulled by the sameness of the dark ceiling, and she was like a creature from a dream, storming into the room, smelling as she did. The sheets getting damp when she crawled in beside me. I believed she'd come for me. To be with me, a gesture of apology. But how quickly that thought disappeared when I took in her urgency, her stoned, glassy focus. I knew this was for him. "Come on," Suzanne said, and laughed, her face new in the strange blue light. "It's beautiful," she said. "You'll see. He's gentle." Like that was the most you could hope for. I sat back, grabbing the covers. "Mitch is a creep," I said. It was clear to me that we were in a stranger's house. The oversized, empty guest room with its unsavory off-gassing of other bodies. "Avi," she said, "don't be like that." Her nearness, the dart of her eyes in the dark. How easily she pressed her mouth to mine, then edging her tongue past my lips, running the tip along the ridges of my teeth, smiling into my mouth, and saying something I couldn't hear. I could taste the cocaine drip in her mouth, the brackish sea. I went to kiss her again, but she had already drifted away, smiling like this was a game, like we'd done something funny and unreal, playing lightly with my hair. I was happy to twist the meanings, willfully misread the symbols. Doing what Suzanne asked seemed like the best gift I could give her. A way to unlock her own reciprocal feelings. And she was trapped in her way, just like I was. But I never saw that, shifting easily in the directions she prompted for me. like the wooden toy, clattering with the silver ball I'd tilted and urged into the painted holes, trying for the winning drop. Mitch's room was big, and the tile floor was cold. The bed was on a raised platform, carved with Balinese figures. He grinned when he saw me behind Suzanne, showing a quick flash of teeth, and opened his arms to us, his bare chest foaming with hair. Suzanne went right to him, but I sat on the edge of the bed, hands folded in my lap. Mitch raised up on his elbows.
"No," he said, patting the mattress. "Here. Come here."
I scooted over to lie beside him. I could feel Suzanne's impatience, how she sidled to him like a dog.
"I don't want you yet," Mitch said to her.
I couldn't see Suzanne's face, but I could imagine the swift hurt.
"Can you take these off?"
Mitch tapped at my underwear with his hand. I was ashamed. They were full-seated and childish, the elastic limp. I lowered them down my hips until they were around my knees.
"Oh, God," Mitch said, sitting up. "Can you open your legs a little?"
I did. He crouched over me. I could feel his face close to my childish mound. His snout had the wet heat of an animal.
"I'm not going to touch you,"
Mitch said, and I knew he was lying.
"Jesus,"
he breathed. He gestured Suzanne over, murmuring low, placing us like dolls, announcing fussy asides to no one in particular. Suzanne looked to me like a stranger in that strange room, like the part of her I recognized had retreated. He sucked my tongue into his mouth. I could stay still, mostly, while Mitch kissed me, and accept his probing tongue with a hollow distance, even his fingers inside me like something curious and without meaning. Mitch lifted himself and pushed inside me, groaning a little when it was difficult. He spit on his hand and rubbed me, then tried again, and how sudden it was, his jacking between my legs, and how I kept thinking to myself with some surprise and disbelief that it was actually happening. And then I felt Suzanne's hand snake over and grab mine. Maybe Mitch nudged Suzanne in my direction, but I didn't see. When Suzanne kissed me again, I was lulled into thinking she was doing it for me, that this was our way to be together, that Mitch was just the background noise, the necessary excuse that allowed for her eager mouth, the curl of her fingers. I could smell myself and smell her, too. A sound deep in her throat that I believed was meant for me, as if her pleasure were at some pitch Mitch couldn't hear. She moved my hand to her breast, shivering when I touched the nipple, closing her eyes like I had done something good. Mitch rolled off me in order to watch, kneading the wet head of his dick, the mattress slanting toward his weight. I kept kissing Suzanne, so different from kissing a man. Their forceful mash getting across the idea of a kiss, but not this articulation. I pretended Mitch wasn't there, though I could feel his gaze, his mouth as slack as the open trunk of a car. I was skittish when Suzanne tried to push apart my legs, but she smiled up at me, so I let her. Her tongue was tentative, first. Then she used her fingers, too, and I was embarrassed at how wet I was, the noises I made, my mind fritzing from a pleasure so foreign I didn't know how to name it. Mitch fucked us both after that, like he could correct our obvious preference for each other. Sweating hard, his eyes crimping with effort, the bed moving away from the wall. When I woke up in the morning and saw the soiled twist of my underwear on Mitch's tile floor, such helpless embarrassment bubbled up in me that I almost cried. Mitch drove us back to the ranch. I was silent, looking out the windows. The passing houses seemed long dormant, the fancy cars shrouded in their putty-colored covers. Suzanne was sitting in the front.
She turned around to smile at me from time to time. An apology, I could tell. But I was stone-faced, my heart a tight fist. A grief that I didn't fully indulge. I was shoring up the bad feelings, I suppose. Like I could preempt sorrow with my bravado. With the careless way I thought about Suzanne, to myself. And I'd had sex. So what? It was no big deal. Another working of the human body. Like eating. Something rote and accessible to everyone. All the pious and pastel urgings to wait, to make yourself into a present for your future husband. There was a relief in the plainness of the actual act. I watched Suzanne from the back seat, watched her laugh at something Mitch said and roll down the window. Her hair lifting in the rush. Mitch pulled up at the ranch.
"Later, girls," he said, raising a pink palm, like he'd taken us for ice cream, some innocent outing, and was returning us to the cradle of our parents' house.
Suzanne had gone immediately in search of Russell, cleaving from me without a word. I realized later that she must have been giving Russell a report, letting him know how Mitch had seemed, whether we'd made him happy enough to change his mind. At the time, I only noticed the abandonment. I tried to busy myself peeling garlic in the kitchen with Donna, smashing cloves between the flat blade of a knife and the counter, like she showed me. Donna slid the radio knob from one end of the dial to the other and back, getting varying degrees of static and alarming strains of Herb Alpert. She gave up finally and returned to jabbing at a mess of black dough.
"Ruse put Vaseline in my hair," Donna said. She gave a shake and her hair barely moved. "It's gonna be real soft when I wash it."
I didn't answer. Donna could tell I was distracted and catted her eyes over at me.
"Did he show you the fountain in the backyard?" she said. "He got it from Rome. Mitch's place has high vibes," she went on. "All the ions, 'cause of the ocean."
I reddened, trying to concentrate on separating the garlic from its woody husks. The buzz of the radio suddenly seemed nasty, polluting, the announcer talking too fast. They'd all been there, I understood, to Mitch's strange house by the sea. I'd enacted some pattern, been defined neatly as a girl providing a known value. There was something almost comforting about it, the clarity of purpose, even as it shamed me. I didn't understand that you could hope for more. I hadn't seen the fountain. I did not say so. Donna's eyes were bright.
"You know," she said, "Suzanne's parents are actually real rich. Propane or something. She never was homeless or anything, either."
She was working the dough on the counter as she spoke.
"Didn't end up in any hospital. Any of that shit she says. Just scratched herself up with a paperclip on some freaky jag."
I was queasy from the stench of food scraps softening in the sink. I shrugged like I didn't much care either way. Donna went on.
"You don't believe me," she said, "but it's true. We were up in Mendocino, crashing with an apple farmer. She'd done too much acid, just started working away at herself with that clip until we made her quit. She didn't even bleed, though."
When I didn't respond, Donna slammed the dough into a bowl, punching it down.
"Think whatever you want," she said.
Suzanne came into her bedroom later, while I was changing. I hunched myself protectively over my naked chest. Suzanne noticed and seemed ready to mock me, but stopped herself. I saw the scars on her wrist, but didn't indulge the uneasy questions. Donna was just jealous. Never mind Donna and her stiff Vaseline hair, shanky and foul as a muskrat's.
"Last night was a trip," Suzanne said.
I pulled away when she tried to sling her arm around me.
"Oh, come on. You were into it," she said. "I saw."
I made a sick face. She laughed. I occupied myself with tidying the sheets, as if the bed could ever be anything but a dank nest.
"Ah, it's fine," Suzanne said. "I got something to cheer you up."
I thought she was going to apologize, but then it occurred to me she was going to kiss me again. The dim room got airless. I almost felt it happen, an imperceptible lean. But Suzanne just hefted her bag onto the bed, the fringe pooling on the mattress. The bag was full of a strange weight. She gave me a triumphant look.
"Go on," she said. "Look inside."
Suzanne huffed at my stubbornness and opened it herself. I didn't understand what was inside, the odd metallic flash, the sharp corners.
"Take it out," Suzanne said, impatient.
It was a gold record, framed in glass, much heavier than expected. She nudged me.
"We got him, huh?"
Her expectant look. Was this meant to explain something? I stared at the name, engraved on a small plaque. Mitch Lewis, The Sun King album. Suzanne started laughing.
"Man, you should see your face right now," she said. "Don't you know I'm on your side?"
The record glinted dully in the dark room, but even its pretty Egyptian gleam failed to stir me. It was just an artifact of that strange house, nothing so valuable. Already the weight was making my arms tired.